Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, August 19th. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening for the Solari Report. Tonight we have Money and Markets, and Ask Catherine, and then an interview with Professor Victor Mayer of the University of Pennsylvania on the classic masterpiece of strategy, Sun Tzu's Art of War. Our theme tonight is the big chicken. It's deja vu all over again. That's in honor of Yogi Berra. It's deja vu all over again. The big chicken is my very defensive portfolio strategy, including avoiding U.S. equities. Those of you who have heard me say on Money and Markets before, my estimate of my expectation for likely scenario this year is mostly slow burn, but we're in danger of a real meltdown. And to protect the bond markets, the stock markets are going to take the hit. And someone asked me to mention the fact this week that I'm still in the big chicken, which I clearly am. It's interesting to look at the news this week. It turns out I'm far from the only one. There are a lot of people joining me in the big chicken. The SEC has been publishing its second quarter filings and market commentators going through them. Those include investment manager holdings, among others. Soros has slashed his U.S. equities in the second quarter. That story is top of the blog, leaving his biggest position in precious metals, but GLD. For those of you who still hold GLD, please read our special report on GLD and SLV. You can link to it from either the homepage or the article section on the website. You want to make sure you understand the risks of being in the ETFs, and that article does a good job of describing the risks of the precious metals ETFs, but many of those concerns apply to a lot of the ETFs. You know, they're fine for the slow burn, but in a serious crunch, there's some real problems. Soros's former hedge fund partner, interestingly enough, billionaire Stanley Druckenmiller, he's feeling even stronger. He announced this week he was closing his fund and retiring, having a losing year, which for him was unusual. He has quite a 30-year record. Probably the greatest oddities coming out of the SEC filings was an indication by Harvard that they were slashing. The first report was all of their Israeli equities. They came back and insisted that wasn't true, but clearly they are disinvesting a significant position, and you wonder what that is about. So the big chicken, lots of people in the big chicken, more and more indication that the U.S. market is really supported by an extraordinary percentage of high program trading as retail leaves the market. Okay, there's a blog post on financing farming in the U.S. What happened this week was last week one subscriber sent me the post financing farming in the U.S., and then another subscriber, I mentioned it last week, another subscriber wrote me and said, I mentioned it to Flow Money and they weren't sure what you were saying, and so I finally wrote it all up, and I really recommend it to you. One of the things we're going to be talking about is food. The big story, though, this week is what will happen in Iran and in the Middle East when Iran brings its nuclear reactor online this weekend. It's going to take about a month for it to get to really to power up, but the process is supposedly going to start this weekend. The answer is I don't know. The suspense was very heightened by the movement of the combat troops out of Iraq as of last evening. They moved into Kuwait last night. That still leaves 50,000 non-combat U.S. troops and lots of mercenaries behind. So Iraq is far from without a U.S. occupation. I've been watching the fires and drought conditions in Russia and continually wondering if HAARP weaponry has anything to do with Russia's troubles and what that has to do with Russia's continued support of Iran and developments in the Middle East and Eurasia. On the HAARP issue, if you didn't have the opportunity to listen to the Nick Beglich interview on HAARP and the related two-hour interview with Clifford Carnicom on global spraying and what that might have to do with HAARP, I strongly recommend that to you. You know, we live in a world where something like the Russian troubles can have something to do with what's going on in Iran and trying to prevent a real war, even a nuclear war there. So it's very important to understand that technology. So after Iran and troubles in the Middle East, another important theme was food. I mentioned last week the importance of increasing food price reports. This week, BHP tendered in a hostile bid now for potash at a bid of about $39 billion. The Senate, unfortunately for us, reached agreement on the food safety bill. Both of these are indications that there is more and more of a consensus of the importance of the strategic control of good farmland, seed, food supply. All that continues to increase, and the backdrop to that is food prices are not only rising but expected to rise much more. It's interesting, Half Past Human, Cliff High, put out a new run of The Shape to Things to Come. I always find those very interesting because the WebBot program at Half Past Human does, I think, a very interesting job of scanning and collecting huge amounts of data, and then Cliff and his team synthesize it. And it really is a mapping tool for mapping what a lot of people are thinking about. It's kind of a way of getting a much more broad-based media than we'll get through the corporate media. And when one of the things you see in his description is the importance of food, the dangers of food shortages, and real politics of food around the world. I really want you to think for your household budget, if food prices were to increase 10 to 20% a year for the next 3 years and the transparency of what was in food that you brought in the grocery stores continued to decline and what was in the grocery stores was getting more and more corporate and controlled, I really want you to think about how you would jump the curve on that situation and how you can make sure your ability to buy real food is enhanced by other methods than maybe some of the traditional manners we've all shop for food. If you have not checked out the local version of your ediblecommunities.com local food magazine, I would really encourage it. It's a wonderful network of local food magazines that are connecting people with it. The subscription is very reasonable, and it's a great way to find food resources in your place. Again, the Financing Farms in America commentary is up on the blog, and I would encourage you to read it. The bottom line of what I'm saying is that what small farmers need is more profits. What they don't need is what was recommended in the study, which is to go to government for more capital. What we need is for government to stop doing things that destroy their profits as opposed to providing them with subsidized capital while they do destroy their profits. If you're interested in that whole issue, which is a very important issue to attracting venture capital to local fresh food, and that's part and parcel of kickstarting local economies. There was a very chilling study published, and I encourage you to read it, although it's very chilling. New study, rats when they are fed unlimited amount of junk food would starve rather than eat healthy food once the junk food was pulled away from them. Their addiction to junk food was so great that they couldn't convert to healthy food. It's a very scary study, but it's a great reminder to get into your spirit of why it's so important to keep kids away from junk food. In the housing markets, the Treasury held their conference on Tuesday. There was lots of talk, but no due on Freddie, Fannie, and housing. The administration says it's planning on coming up with a proposal for reengineering the housing market in 2011. There is so much underwater paper, and it's not because the market's down. It's because that portfolio is full of fraud that, more fraud than it's easy to fathom. That are really at this point you're pushing the string and using the Treasury to fund the mess, and rates being low is part and parcel of what it takes to just keep pushing that portfolio and working it out. Meantime, those rates mean it's a good time to refinance your mortgage, although if you can, it's also, in my opinion, a good time to pay off your mortgage and get out of the system and debt entirely. Municipal market, a very interesting thing happened. The SEC has sued and now settled a securities case against the state of New Jersey for not disclosing shortfalls in their pension funds to bond investors in their official statement. A state or local government's prospectus is called an official statement, not a prospectus. This is the first time the SEC has sued a state for securities fraud. The presence of more federal enforcement against states in this area, to me, is a worrisome sign. I've mentioned several times the new provision in the financial reform bill that gives the SEC jurisdiction over municipal financial advisors. To me, there are real constitutional issues about whether the feds have the right to put these kinds of controls on federal finances. The more the federal government controls the rules regarding state pension funds and state financing and local as well, including the people who serve and advise those states, the greater the fraud in the financial system is going to be. So it's a disturbing trend and not good news for municipal bonds or the economy. The state and local cutbacks continue to happen. The Fed is doing everything they can to make it difficult for the states to pull the plug on a lot of the federal drain or seek greater financial independence. And what you're starting to see, you know, it's always surprising to me how little understanding there is in the business community about the dependency of local economies and corporate economies on government money, but how big a portion of it state and local government is, particularly when you include the pension funds. And we're starting to see a lot more consciousness and understanding of what a big portion of the GNP is and how that can cycle through the whole economy, including parts of the economy that think they have nothing to do with government. In the bond market, there was a great editorial. It's up on the blog. It's from the New York Times, from members of the Wisdom Tree Funds Group, about the dangers of a bond bubble. With the fixed income yields having dropped this much, bond prices really are high. And on long maturities, there is a lot of risk for not much return. There's a surprising amount of predictions both in the mainstream press and the blogosphere saying that the U.S. will default on treasuries, which I still have trouble understanding. Anyway, I got this question more than a few times this week, so I wanted to make sure I discussed it tonight. If I can simply print paper, remember, you can satisfy a treasury bond by simply just printing more U.S. currency. Now, yes, when the bond gets paid off, that paper may be worthless. That's what hyperinflation and John Williams at Shadow Stats is talking about and warning about. But why would I default if I could just simply print the paper? Now, the second argument as to why the U.S. would default is because the U.S. is bankrupt, and so we can't possibly pay off our debt with the resources that we have. It's important to remember that the dollar and treasuries, in essence, at this point, are reserve currency for the globe, and the economics of paying them back are really the land and natural resources of the whole planet. That's what building the empire is about, and that's what has got everybody across the planet irritated. They don't want to be part of the U.S. empire, so they're sort of irritated about it, but that's why we have military bases around the globe and have spent a small fortune on global satellite surveillance systems, software, and invisible weaponry. So it's not surprising. The latest Gallup poll shows that the military continues to be the most respected institution in the U.S., and that really indicates that people know where their money's coming from, whether it's from a defense contract or an inflated dollar. But those are the fundamentals of the economics. And one of the things that the half-past human publication, The Shape of Things to Come, warned, and I should just note, you can download it from their website for $10. They're selling them per report, not for the whole series now, is real concern that a lot of people are going to put a lot of passion and effort into the federal elections this November and be disappointed. It's very important to remember that elections are a time to meet and talk with other people in your area about issues of real concern. A lot of the elections can be extremely important, the local election, state and local. I talked earlier about my sheriff election. But it's very important to understand that, especially given the dependency of the economics on the central banking warfare model, it's hard to expect Congress to be able to do a lot about some of the problems we face. So it's very important when you head into the elections to understand what can be gotten from them and to not lose too much time. My hero of the week is, believe it or not, this week is Roman Polanski. I just saw his new movie, Ghost Rider. It's an extraordinary accomplishment for a man who's in the middle of very fierce litigation at his age. While he was working on the movie, the United States government was trying to extradite him back to Los Angeles on an old and very bitter case. The story of Ghost Rider is about a former British minister, a British prime minister, working on his memoirs with a ghostwriter after the first ghostwriter has been killed. The prime minister really does remind you of Tony Blair, and basically the movie ends up blaming the CIA for just about everything wrong in the world. And you can certainly see why the Anglo-American Alliance would be irritated with Polanski for making the movie, even irritated enough possibly to revive his legal problems, although I don't know that that's where it came from. The fact that the movie was quite good and Polanski ended up beating them in court is really a sign of a very talented and courageous artist. Our compliments to the Swiss courts for refusing last month to extradite Polanski. The U.S. courts had abrogated on their agreements with Polanski and his attorney long ago. They really, you know, the U.S. judicial system looks bad in the story. So there's no reason that any court in the world should respect their renewed efforts on this one, but we tip our hat to both Polanski and the Swiss courts. Okay, Ask Catherine. I put a very interesting chart up on the blog which showed the German unemployment rates really dropping very low relative to the French. And if you look at the German unemployment rate, it really is quite extraordinary compared to those in the other first world nations. I got a question from one subscriber who said, what is Germany doing right? And I've done some research. One of the things that Germany has done right is they have kept much more manufacturing in Germany, particularly high-skilled and the more sophisticated manufacturing. And as a result, you have more employment and more high-paid labor jobs, although the Germans will grouse and say that everybody's also working at low wages now. So certainly the German people feel the same pressures that we do. I had for years a very, very wonderful collaboration with Paul Atkinson, who'd been the president of Sun Shipbuilding in Philadelphia, and I spent years sort of wandering around the old shipbuilding plant and other manufacturing plants. And it was Paul who really persuaded me that the movement of manufacturing abroad in this country in the 80s and 90s had was nowhere near as much about accessing cheaper labor abroad as it was moving equity in a way that gave control to a new group of people and basically siphoned off equity and control from the old group. So when you move the manufacturing, it left the United States owned by one group, and it showed up in a new place owned by another. So it was much more a financial coup d'etat than just cheap labor. The cheap labor aspects of it you see, again, in that wonderful video of Sir James Goldsmith talking about the WTO and the change in the economy. Germany's success in keeping high-quality manufacturing has really made a difference because they have kept the high-quality manufacturing, and it really argues in favor of Paul's thesis. One thing also on the blog this week on the economic front was reports that in Greece unemployment was as high as 70% in some areas. It's a perfect example of an economic hit on a country, what not to do if you want employment. One of the most important books, one of the top books on my list for the 21st century, which is one of the big questions at the blog that I'm responding to sort of book by book, is Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine, and it's one I hope to get Klein on the Solari Report next year. It's great background for what not to do, and it's great background to understand what's going on in Greece, and so I recommend it strongly to you, Naomi Klein, What Not to Do. Another question in Ask Catherine was, how can the U.S. bring back manufacturing? Would it help our economy? If not, what will? Very quickly, this is a great question. One of the things that would help our economy tremendously is allocating government spending based on an integrated return on investment criteria. So, for example, if the example I keep using, if the state food stamp program is outsourcing customer service jobs to a corporation in another country, and in the meantime facilitating purchase of food coming in from other countries while also paying people not to work through welfare, unemployment, or other kind of subsidies, it's cheaper to pay more for the food and grow it locally and more for the labor if the net cost of paying people not to work and outsourcing is on a net cost integrated basis less expensive. So that's a perfect area where we could significantly reduce the pressure on taxpayers and government budgets and get a lot more economic activity in a very value-added way. Step one to doing that is getting mastery of government budgets and finances in your area and begin to identify opportunities to re-engineer, which can save money for the taxpayers and start to create local income and equity, which generates more money in taxes. So it's kind of a, you know, it hits on both sides of the income statement and the balance sheet. Another way to increase U.S. manufacturing is to focus on value-added clean technology that can be prototyped here and serve U.S. and also be exported to foreign markets. There is a lot more provision, particularly at the state level, focus on renewable energy. So I expect to see that start to kick in. And again, I want to make a plug for local food. It's not manufacturing per se. It's Mother Nature manufacturing. But it is an absolutely essential part of generating the cash flows you need in a place to also kickstart some of the clean technology and other kinds of innovations that really make sense to institute and would build a manufacturing base. So it's all part of this is also our willingness to shift our time, attention, and investments accordingly. Okay, well, it's my pleasure to introduce to you someone very special for a discussion of Sun Tzu's The Art of War. Again, one of the big questions at the card from subscribers is, what are the best books to help me navigate the 21st century? We've done some of them. We've done Deep Survival with Larry Gonzalez, Family Wealth by Jay Hughes, two great books. I mentioned Naomi Klein. But one of the books at the very top of my list is Sun Tzu's Art of War. And I had read it in college, found it interesting, but it didn't. I can't say it made a profound impact on my life at that point. And then when I was involved in 11 years of litigation, I kept asking every member of the intelligence community that I would bump into, and just about every litigator would look at me and say, you need to read The Art of War. In fact, you need to memorize The Art of War. You need to really take The Art of War to heart. And one of the things I discovered is the extent to which both the business, the litigation, and the intelligence community, and since then the military community, really do consider this one of their must-read books. And so I started to read it again and again. And when we decided we would do it on the Soleri Report, I said to my wonderful production assistant, Mike Linton, who's a professor here in Tennessee, I said, we've got to find the top person in the world on Art of War. You know, you're an academic, you go figure it out. And so he did tremendous amounts of research, and he came back and we reviewed his results and said, okay, this guy at the University of Pennsylvania is clearly the best guy. And one of the reasons is that that if you know the Art of War is really a book that is very much based in the cultural and philosophic traditions of the time in which it was written. It really is a book in which an understanding of Chinese Taoism is very important, and Professor Mayer is really an expert in all these things. So with that, Professor Mayer, are you with us?
Yes, here I am.
I should also say you're a professor of Chinese language and literature in the Department of East Asian Languages and Civilizations at the University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, where I grew up and went to school.
You're from Philadelphia.
I'm from West Philadelphia.
Oh my goodness!
I grew up on 48th Street.
Right.
Anyways.
Yep.
So tell us a little bit about your background and how it was you came to translate the Sun Tzu.
Well, I think I could say that the main reason I'm in Oriental Studies or Asian Studies is because I joined the Peace Corps, which is a little bit ironic for somebody who ends up writing about war. But war and peace are part of a dyad, so you can't have one without the other. They're like the yin-yang symbol. There's a little bit of peace in war, and there's war and peace. So I was an English major in college, but I went to the Peace Corps in Nepal and got interested in Buddhism and eventually became a sinologist, which is a philologist who studies China.
Uh-huh.
So I translated a lot of ancient Chinese texts, including the Laozi, which is the foundational text for Taoist philosophy, and another very important Taoist philosophical work called the Zhuangzi, which in my translation is called Wandering on the Way. So a lot of people think that the Sunzi, which is known in English usually as the Art of War, is not very compatible with these Taoist texts, but I have a very different approach to that.
Oh, I think it's very much about how to win without war, or without violence, and if you're forced to go to war, how to win with as little expenditure of bloodshed and resources as possible.
Exactly. It's quite different. You could say opposite from Clausewitz, the most important Western strategist of war. Because Clausewitz says, you know, war is a matter of great force, and you can't avoid bloodshed. You just have to face it. And if you can't do that, you're not going to be a good general. But the good general in Sun Tzu's way of looking at things is the one who can avoid these confrontations by various clever means. And I think that's going to be the main topic of our discussion this evening is just what means could be employed to avoid lots of casualties and lots of expenditures.
One of the things I love about your translation is that I finally understand. You know, you always felt that there was no way this could be written by just one guy.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things you really do describe in detail is, you know, the issues of where this text came from and who really wrote it. So maybe
yeah,
if
the
you
history
could
of the composition.
Yeah.
Traditionally, people just think it was written by a man named Sun Tzu, your master Sun.
Uh-huh.
Tzu means master, like philosophical master, and that he lived in the 6th or 7th century B.C. But my very detailed and careful research shows that there never was such a person.
So that statue that you always see standing, that's just a mythological character?
Exactly. I mean, they had to have somebody to attach this text to. Actually, in my translation of the Tao Te Ching, I also say the same thing about Laozi.
Laozi
of the Tao Te Ching, yeah.
Yeah.
And he also was projected back to the same time period, like 6th or 7th century B.C., which is 3 or 4 centuries too early for when the text actually came into being. And we now know when these texts were actually written and when they came into existence, because amazingly we're finding coming up out of the earth because of all the archaeological discoveries in China. We're finding evidence of the text in process of composition from later periods. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
We find what we call tomb texts. They're manuscripts that are buried with people, and then we see the text sort of growing accretionally.
Do you see what gets edited out?
Excuse me?
Do you see what gets edited
out?
That's
a very good question. Yeah, you do. You see what gets edited out, and you see what gets repeated. And one point that I make, both with the Tao Te Ching, the Laozi, and with the Sun Tzu, the Art of War, is that there was a large body of wisdom. You know, in the case of the Sun Tzu, it would be military wisdom. You know, aphoristic sayings that were sort of floating around in society. And essentially what the people who put this text together did was gather them and sort of edit or compile them into this text. And one of the things I do in this book that nobody else has ever done is really look very seriously at the grammatical construction of the way it's sort of sewn together. And I talk a lot about the very unique way in which conjunctions are used to stitch the text together. That's never been done in any language, that kind of analysis.
I studied Mandarin for several years, and I tried briefly to grapple with the ancient Chinese, and it's a very, it's really an artistic endeavor to try and understand it and translate it.
Absolutely. You simply have to read huge quantities of it and get a sort of intuitive sense of what is being said or what is meant to be said. Because so many things that we take for granted in Indo-European languages like English or German, which are very explicit and very, what should I say, the grammar has to be spelled out very clearly. You have to have a subject, then a verb, and an object. But in Chinese, it's very common to dispense with the subject. It's almost more common to have to just leave the subject out, and then you have to figure out from the context what it is.
Right. Uh-huh. Now, you describe this in your book as the art of war is really the Taoistic approach to warfare.
Hmm.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, everybody in ancient China believed in the Tao, which is the way, but they had different interpretations. And when I say Tao here, I'm talking about the philosophical Taoists who thought of Tao as an overarching cosmological structural force that knits everything together, sort of like Indian Brahma. So there was this Taoist philosophical school, and then it was initiated by Laozi and Zhuangzi, the two texts that I mentioned earlier. And then later, religious Taoists, much later, developed this philosophical tradition into a religion. And they're quite different, philosophical Taoism and religious Taoism. But the religious Taoists of later times respected Laozi and Zhuangzi, those two early texts. So when I say that the Xunzi is a Taoistic approach to war, what I'm saying is that it was actually taken very seriously and put into the Taoist canon, which sounds a little bit odd because we usually think of Taoists as being uninterested in war. But the thing about this text is that it's looking at war almost with fear and not with eagerness, that you want to avoid war. So,
war's not looked as good business. It's looked as bad business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
War
is bad. War is bad for business.
It's wasteful.
It's wasteful.
So what I say in my introduction, I say that war is a matter of the last resort. It's what you don't do it eagerly. You don't. You only undertake it with the when you try to undertake it with the least amount of effort, the least expenditure, and the least risk. So in the least loss of life. So I say that it's a minimalist approach to warfare, which is what Taoism is like too, in terms of approach to life.
One of the things that's always struck me here is that it is a philosophy, or it's a text that came together in a world that was much more resource conscious. Whereas if you look at the European military strategy or U.S. military strategy, it's a much resource-rich world. You know, it's let's issue a lot of bonds and spend a lot of money and outforce the thing.
Yeah.
And so one is resource optimizing and one is resource wasteful or rich.
Exactly. And then this leads into how you prosecute war, how you actually carry it out. And I think right today, China, I suppose you're aware that China and America have increasing tension, for example, in the South China Sea.
Right.
You know, and in the North Sea also between, the American and South Korean naval forces cooperated recently in exercises. Well, China's very aware of all this, and they're also very aware, the Chinese military leaders and the political leaders are very aware of the fact that American force is much superior to theirs. You know, our military armaments, our weaponry, our everything, you can say we outweigh them in terms of military strength, what you call resources. But
right.
So this leads the Chinese to use, in a very Sunzian kind of way, what I call asymmetrical approaches to war. Psychological warfare, in unconventional warfare. And these things are all spelled out in ancient language in the Sunzi. So if you read this book very carefully, you'll see the kind of attitude to this, where you have a disparity of forces, where a weaker army can defeat a much stronger army just by very intelligent application of force at critical moments.
Right. What I see on the U.S. side is, since Vietnam, the U.S. putting tremendous amounts of money into what I would call invisible methods and invisible weaponry.
Mm-hmm.
So in one sense, much more like the art of war, you know, depending on deception, depending on being stealth, depending on intelligence and, you know, what the art of war would describe as spies,
mm-hmm.
although they may be electronic spies in the sky.
And drones.
Well, I remember I was in Hong Kong in 97 and then up in Shanghai and then went to Beijing. In fact, it was the week that Deng's funeral happened.
Oh. Hmm.
And ran into a group of the military, and they were very steamed about what we were doing with satellites.
Ah.
Quite steamed.
Yeah. And I bet you they'd be steamed about SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative,
yes.
too, that sort of thing.
Yeah, very steamed about the sort of invisible intelligence, or, you know, what they considered invasive intelligence methods.
Well, you could say that American military leadership has taken this book to heart also. I mean,
well, you know, it's so interesting to me because, you know, I kept being told, you know, I felt like some days I was getting a letter, you know, this is a message from the CIA, you will read The Art of War. And in some respects, I see what the U.S. is doing is very much in alignment with this book. But to me, the power of this writing is the descriptions of how the leaders need to understand their culture and align with their culture and bring out the best in their culture, and that is part of, you know, the power of going to war when you have that alignment. And yet the U.S. is moving totally away from that.
Well, you know, this book is saying over and over again, it repeats the idea that if you know, they say in no uncertain terms, if you understand yourself and you understand the enemy, then you will always be victorious. But it's very reminiscent of the oracle at Delphi,
mm-hmm.
which says, know thyself, except that in this book also it emphasizes knowing your enemy. So what you were talking about is aligning yourself with your culture, your tradition. It's sort of like knowing yourself in context.
How does the way fit in with the Chinese concept of the mandate of heaven?
Oh, well, that's...
You can say not at all.
I would say that this has to do with historical context because the mandate of heaven has to do with a certain dynasty.
Okay.
Of course, the Zhou dynasty, which was the first of the imperial dynasties. Heaven speaks to us with this mandate, and then whoever's anointed with that mandate will be able to rule the empire.
Mm-hmm.
That heaven there is called Tian, and the way is Dao, and they come from different backgrounds. But then after they get established in Chinese culture, they sort of go along in parallel.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, either one is it's a stress on moral authority. And
yes,
there's a real discipline that leadership is held to. that I think is remarkable and is not, if you look at the Clausewitz kind of strategy, it's missing. You know, that's much more, and I almost wonder if the difference to a certain extent wasn't our creation in the West of a bond market, and a taxation system that could make the ruler pretty much not care what the people thought.
Yeah, it's all a matter of mechanics, right?
And right.
Forces. Whereas it's true that in the Chinese situation, and a lot having to do with the Confucian tradition, is that moral authority is very much at issue.
Yeah. Well, take us through the book and just go through the key points again.
Well, I would say that it emphasizes this kind of deception. That's one of the key things we all know about. And what I want to say about deception is that it doesn't mean exactly lying outright.
Uh-huh.
What it's sort of, I think it's better to understand deception. I mean, as an athlete, I used to play basketball. As an athlete doing what you call a feint or a fake.
Uh-huh.
So that you sort of trick your opponent by leading him or her to believe that you're going to do one thing and then you do the exact opposite. And I had to guard Bill Bradley. So he
oh, really?
Was very good at that. Yeah. The masters of this kind of deception in sports were people like Larry Bird or Bill
uh-huh.
Bradley, who could, you know, they would look in there, give you a look that led you to believe they were going to do one thing, go one way, and then go completely the other way.
Right.
So that's what you have to do in warfare, and it's...
And it's important to be a little bit unpredictable.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So that if you're predictable, then you're just going to keep falling into traps because people will anticipate what you're going to do.
I used to, when I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, I used to have something called my sugar packet goals.
Mm-hmm.
And those were my goals for my term as Assistant Secretary, and I had to be able to write them on a sugar packet.
Oh.
If I couldn't write them on a sugar packet, then I wasn't clear. And then I had to be able to hold them in my hand, and no one could ever know what my sugar packet goals were. Because then if that's what you want, then everybody uses it to toll booth you. And so
yeah.
You've got to persuade them that there's something else you want, and they destroy your ability to do that. In the meantime, you can get your sugar packet goals done.
The other thing to do is, like you mentioned before, the importance of spies and intelligence. And we can use that in business, in our daily life, in the sense of gathering information. Intelligence for the individual or for the corporation is just making a good effort to find out what the situation is that you're facing. That's intelligence. So this book also is very important. The book originally, I think, was written for infantry. Not for cavalry, because it really doesn't mention horses at all.
It really doesn't, which surprises me, because they were great horsemen, weren't they?
Well, no. The Chinese were
not very poor horsemen at that time?
Very, very poor horsemen. So the fact that the horses aren't mentioned in this book also tells us something about when it was written, because
right.
The Chinese actually learned to ride horses late in the late 4th century. And they learned to ride the horses from the steppe nomads.
Uh-huh.
So in the earliest stage of Chinese warfare that we know much about, they were using chariotry. But the chariots were sort of like, they were like command platforms, mobile command platforms. And they did have some chariot warfare. But it was very much, the earliest stage of Chinese warfare was very aristocratic, and so it would be like noble warriors fighting against each other, rather like the early Greek warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And then, by the time this Sun Tzu gets to be written, you have large armies. And that's why the general is so important in this book, because the general organizes the armies. It's a very different situation from those aristocratic noble warriors who were just like individual great knights in a way. But here you're dealing with very large tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of troops.
But they're keeping money.
Yeah. Well, then you have to figure out how to feed them and
right.
where to house them and their this book to, and how to position them on the land.
So right. One of the things I love is all the description of why it's so important that your army eat your enemy's food.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's very hard to supply your own army, so get their food.
Right.
And then when this book is finished, they start to utilize horses in China. So you can see that it's that's sort of the end point of this book. They really don't even talk about horses at all. And they do have, you know, in terms of technology, iron was just getting to be important during this period. It was sort of like the Iron Age.
Mm-hmm.
Before that was the Bronze Age. In the Bronze Age, bronze is a kind of metal for aristocrats. It's harder to make large amounts of bronze weapons. Once you learn iron technology, you can make mass amount of weapons and equip soldiers, a lot of soldiers with weapons. So that's the, and then you get the warriors, the cavalrymen. But that this book doesn't even really touch on that, which is very interesting. Oh, there's another very key fact, concept in this book. Which is the most difficult term for me to translate was this term shi. It gets translated in so many different ways. I ended up translating it as configuration, but some people translate it as inertia, or it gets translated different ways depending upon the context. But the idea is sort of like you have a boulder at the top of a mountain, and you just touch it. And it goes rolling down and sweeps everything in its path. It's that sense of getting your troops positioned. And I would say in business, it's getting all of your marbles lined up.
Right. It's finding the leverage, the butterfly effect.
Uh-huh. Now, I would recommend if to people who are listening that they really read Arthur Waldron's brilliant foreword to this book.
A very good foreword.
Unbelievable. I'm so happy to have it in this book. And, you know, he gets into calculus and he shows with graphs the really stark difference between Clausewitz and Sun Tzu. And Sun Tzu is very interested in what I would call tipping points.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And that relates to this business of sure. You know, the tipping
points. And I keep going back, it's not just tipping points in the material aspect, it's tipping points in the, you know, sort of the spiritual, cultural,
mm-hmm.
you know, the feeling points.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that if your troops, your resources are in an advantageous position and also in the right kind of spirit, then they're unconquerable. So that's why it's so important to line them up in the right places and why it's so essential to know what the advantageous positions are. That's what there's so many chapters in this book that are about terrain. So that it has to do with real armies, of course, but it also has to do with psychological vantage points, I would
right.
say.
Yes, it's very good that way. And it took me reading it many times to really understand. Or I think it's something you need to read very carefully and slowly and think about as you read.
Yeah.
Or my kind of way is to read.
See, Clausewitz spends so much time talking about actually how to drill troops, how to equip them, you know, all the nitty-gritty of the real baggage and that sort of thing. But, you know, you barely have, in Sun Tzu, he really doesn't talk about that kind of day-to-day marshalling of the troops. He's more interested in attitudes and ideas and feelings.
Well, it's a world where war, you know, power conflicts are never over. you know, you don't just win and go home. It's kind of, it's a fluid thing. It's never over. Right. You're dealing, it's in a funny kind of way, it's much more the way the world is today than, you know, than the Western strategies.
Yeah. There's no final solution.
Right.
You think you've won the war, and then it's going to, it's like that game you play at the fair. You know, you knock one of those little worms sticking up out of the board, and another one pops up somewhere else. It's not
right.
Conclusive.
You're just constantly seeking balance and gets out of balance, and then you use these strategies to get it back in balance, and it's a journey.
You have to be patient. You have to be patient.
Right. Now, my impression is that it was our defeat in Vietnam that really put this text high on the radar screen within the American military and intelligence. Is that correct, or is that just another?
Well, I would say that's more correct than to say that Napoleon used this text, which a lot of people say. And I wasn't able to prove that. I mean, I tried very hard. I think I read 60 biographies of Napoleon. Couldn't find any evidence that he read this text or used it. But I am sure that the Vietnamese defeat, the staving off or defeat of the great American military machine made us really step back and think how guerrillas and how, you know, sort of soft power, Chinese talk a lot about soft power now, how these things really have an impact. And I think American military establishment, you know, our academies, they do take this text very seriously. I can tell you for a fact they do, because I've lectured to them. I've been asked to go to these Army College, Army War College, and Naval War College, and so forth. And they are very, very careful in their reading of this and trying to understand it. But partly to understand the way Chinese undertake warfare, but also to understand what they might get out of it for our own purposes.
And outside of the military or the government, who has expressed interest? Who's reading your book?
Oh, definitely the business schools.
All the guys over at Wharton.
Oh, yeah. That's fun to go over there to talk to them, because they look at it in a very different way than the military does, but they use it. And and also, you know, people use it for sort of personal strategies and personal fulfillment, not just in business, but in daily life. But I think, aside from the military, this Sun Tzu, The Art of War, is looked at most carefully by people in business. But, you know, they also sometimes business people get some mistaken notions about Chinese thought. For example, you know, this whole idea that crisis is opportunity. I've written something on the web about this.
Yes, I've read it. It's very good.
Yeah, I mentioned it in the book, but it's related to Sun Tzu, because he talks about Qi, which is, that's the tipping point kind of thing, you know, critical moment. It doesn't mean what's going to end up is good or bad, but it's a dangerous moment. So I think people who engage in business or in any adventure, there's risk taking. But you want to approach the risk taking in an intelligent way so that the good outcomes are maximized. And I think that this is something that this book helps you to understand, how to maximize the possibly good outcomes from a risky venture.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting because it really is a philosophy that teaches a leader humility.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're in an environment where that, managing the kind of power that a general manages, but doing it with a real... being grounded in with patience and humility is so invaluable.
Yeah, I think it gives strength when one approaches that way, because if you approach with arrogance, you're going to be off balance and get knocked over.
Now, how do we use this in our life? And since you translated this, you spent a lot of time with this text and the commentaries on the text, the context. How did it change your life to understand and read it and take it in the way you have? How do you use it?
I think it taught me, I learned from it that strength, sheer brute, raw strength is not the best way to win. I could say, for example, in argument, you can't just overpower someone with argument. You have to sort of bring them along. You have to use different methods than sheer frontal attack. That's how I've learned something from this book for my own purposes. You know, that's
and
not,
so,
not just relying on my pure mental strength to overcome someone.
So you think this is something that we all can, whatever your life, whatever your career, this is something we can all use?
Yeah, I think anybody, an artist, a dancer, a poet, I think there's something in this book for just about everyone, maybe even a farmer.
Right. Well, the farmer, to me, the farmer's in the middle of one of the greatest regulatory battlegrounds.
Yes. So he's going to have to figure out how to jockey around in that battleground.
Yeah, he's got the weather and the government.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Now we can get the book at Amazon. Any other places you recommend us getting the book?
Well, you could go straight to Columbia University Press. Yeah. But certainly, okay. there's a website called sonshi.com, S-O-N-S-H-I.com, which tracks all of the Art of War translations and scholarship, and it voted mine the best, so you can get it.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, what a great compliment.
Yeah, I was very flattered. They said it was the best translation. I do pride myself on the literary aspects of this translation.
Uh-huh. It's very, very good.
Thank you very much.
And I think, to me, it's more, I feel the ancient Chinese much more in your translation.
You've made my evening because I've worked so hard to bring across the rhythms and the feeling
uh-huh.
of the ancient text. And I'm
well, having tried to do the same and failed, I can really appreciate what's Well, anyway, Professor, thank you so much. To everyone listening, I really recommend this book. It is one of the best books for the 21st century. This is one you really want to read, not only because of who's reading it and how they're taking it to heart, but because it's a much more useful way of thinking about conflicts in a world which is very resource constrained. So I think it's much, as a strategy book, it's just much more appropriate to a world where warfare is both global and intimate. So anyway, so thank you very, very much.
And, thank you very much, Catherine, for having me on the show.
And many blessings on your work.
Okay,
ladies and gentlemen, look for, by the end of the month, podcast number 15. We put the podcast out at the last week of every month when we don't have a Soleri report. Then coming up on September 2nd, Richard Dolan on the national security state. He's got another book I'm on this book tear to answer your question on the best books that I've reviewed on the blog. It's called UFOs in the National Security State. It's on the list because you've often heard me tell the story of the former head of the CIA trying to persuade me that aliens existed, and then when I said, I didn't know that that was the case, I was asked by the head of a think tank, would you like to have lunch with aliens? I said, no, but I'll read some books. And as a result, I ended up for many years reading just a tremendous number of books on issues related to black technology, the black budget. And there's an enormous amount of misinformation and disinformation. But the most useful book I found, and it was very recently, was Richard Dolan's third book in a series on the national security state. And it's really an extraordinary book, easy to read, very well written, and I recommend it to you. So he'll be joining us to talk about that. On September 9th, Precious Metals, we're going to continue on our most important dates with the creation of the Federal Reserve Bank in 1913. It's not only a very important date, but very much at the heart of the discussion on the financial reform bills and the 350-plus regulations that are going to come out of that. We've been working on our article on the financial reform bill, and we've decided to break it down into separate pieces, and I hope to have the first piece out by that September 9th date. It will be on Glass-Steagall. Some of the questions we've gotten is, what was Glass-Steagall? Why didn't we reinstitute it? What in this bill does reinstitute Glass-Steagall? So we're going to take that piece and focus on that first. The other thing I wanted to remind you, I've gotten several comments over the last week by people when I answer the Solari Silver and Gold phone saying, oh my God, you answered the phone, and having to assure them that, you know, I'm in business and we are a business, but we very much, if you have questions on precious metals, please don't be shy. David Lichty and I live to answer your questions and help you on precious metals in whatever form. So please feel free to pick up the phone and call us. We'd love to talk to you. The number is 866-309-9355. You can find it on the website under Solari Silver and Gold. Just click on the logo and when you come into the Solari homepage. So if you just don't know, you know, you just have questions, don't feel shy about calling up and picking up the phone and talk. Our mission is to help protect you and teach you and educate you about precious metals. So we enjoy talking to you, but we're real people and we pick up the phone. So until September 2nd, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.